Soundprint, welcome to Frog. Larry Massett, I'm Frog. Talking backwards, am Frog, and Frog saying in order to point, make Frog. Point is, language, Frog, can shift about, Frog, quite a bit, and Frog can understand it still, you, Frog. Question is, change good or bad? And good or bad, can we do anything about it? Should we, Frog? Listen now as reporter Jay Ingram brings us the talk show, Talk of Tomorrow.
These are the voyages of the starship Enterprise. Its five-year mission, to explore strange new worlds, to seek out new life and new civilizations, to boldly go where no man has gone before.
To boldly go where no man has gone before. One of the most familiar opening lines in the history of television, and one of the most famous split infinitives in the history of modern English. According to the grammar books, we should be saying to go boldly, not boldly go. That we don't is just one example of how much English today has deviated from standard practice. On today's program, we'll go boldly forward into the future of the English language. What will it sound like? Who will control it? We can't know for sure, but all the evidence seems to suggest that the future will contain many more split infinitives, dangling participles, and other assaults on the sensibilities of people like Roy Stokes. He's the former director of the Library School of the University of British Columbia, and a man who takes the English language very seriously. Roy Stokes thinks we've become sloppy, and that sloppiness has reduced our ability to communicate. That's clear, he says, in our use of the word hopefully, as in, hopefully you will understand what this is all about.
I don't know how or why that's crept in. It's ugly, it's inaccurate, and I see no reason for it.
What's wrong with that use?
Well, it doesn't say what it means. I think what is merely meant in those cases, you know, is it is to be hoped that. And this is somewhat different from starting off, you know, with a participle which doesn't really belong there at all.
Roy Stokes argues that adhering strictly to the rules of grammar and spelling leads to the clearest possible communication. But some linguists disagree. Steven Pinker is at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology.
If you actually look at the rules of the grammarian, the rules of the schoolmarm, a lot of them just don't make any sense. They're kind of arbitrary bits of folklore that have been handed down through the generations that really have nothing to do with the logic of language. When the voiceover for Star Trek says, to boldly go where no man has gone before, that's supposedly a barbarism, and you should say to go boldly where no man has gone before. We're not supposed to say, hopefully the Maple Leafs will get into the finals, because the experts say that hopeful should only be used when the subject of the sentence is doing something in a hopeful manner. So you can say that Melvin hopefully turned the record over and sat down back on the couch 11 centimeters closer to Ellen, but you can't say hopefully the Maple Leafs will reach the finals. Now, this makes no sense at all. It's just an arbitrary rule. If you trace them back, a lot of these rules come from oddball theories from hundreds of years ago that didn't make any sense at the time, but have just been perpetuated ever since, sort of like college fraternity hazings, where you learn them at great effort, and so when the younger generation comes around, you insist that they learn them too.
Roy Stokes says that as we become less concerned about correctness in language, we're losing something deeper, our appreciation for English.
I think we've got to see language on two levels. And that is, there's a language which we merely use in order to be able to order a meal in a restaurant. I mean, to know English as we might learn a foreign language before we went to that country in order to be able to get a taxi, get a hotel room, and say, well, yes, I can speak English. And that is the level, I think, at which too many people now, you know, leave their use of language. But the second level, where you take language as something which is rich and powerful and something which can be enjoyed and played around with, so that you enjoy reading a text by someone who can write with style, rather than someone who merely, you know, writes a text, and to be able to use language so that it's, you know, rather like peeling an onion skin, there's always another one beneath it, there's another meaning, you know, there's richness to it. It's that I'm afraid that we're losing.
Robin Lakoff refers to the people who try to hang on to strictly grammatical English as the language bosses. She says their insistence on the rules of English is really all about holding on to power.
Any way that makes somebody else feel awkward, for example, lots of teenagers are known to use the phrase, you know, a lot. If I, as an adult, can say to my teenage offspring every time they say, you know, I say, stop talking like that. Whenever you say, you know, you don't know what you're talking about, it sounds like nonsense to me. I've got a pretty good way to make them tongue-tied immediately. So any way I can make someone nervous about the way they talk, and it can be a split infinitive, and it can be, you know, and it can be multiple negation, I have power over them. I can keep them from being articulate.
Chapter 5, Networking Commands and Functions. This chapter is an authoritative source for the exact syntax and specific details regarding the defaults and behavior of each DBASE command and function, as it is used in programming.
Language changes, and the source of much of that change today is the world of science and technology. It's estimated that 40 to 50,000 scientific and technical terms enter the English language every year, but few of them stir our souls or fire our imaginations. Up until a couple of years ago, using a word like reboot would have drawn contemptuous stares. And what exactly do megabytes in software mean anyway? Why are disks called floppy when they're almost always hard? All these words have been added to English, but what have they contributed? In the 19th century, scientists consulted classicists to help them select terms so specific they would never find their way into everyday usage. It sometimes worked then. It almost never works now. Ann Eisenberg is a columnist for Scientific American magazine with a special interest in the language of science.
Scientists are always coining words and are very hopeful that they will be able to preserve their meaning. No sooner have they, well, they have about 3 or 4 years before people get hold of them and start to use them with great relish and abandon, of course, forgetting entirely what it is that they were supposed to have meant. Quantum is an interesting example. At one time, it meant a small unit, a smallest possible change in a unit of measure, and it had a precise and narrow meaning of this very small change. When people picked it up, because the word was said with reverence, it became a large unit and a large amount of change. So a quantum leap became, instead of this tiny jump, a huge jump, a gigantic leap forward, and the word became its opposite as it came into use, but people enjoyed to use words this way. A scientific language attempts to petrify language and to keep it in one place and not to make it move. But, of course, when people speak language, it changes and is as fluid as the Mississippi is being right now. There's no way of constraining language or keeping it narrow in the way that you would like. If it's spoken, its meanings will change.
Nobody really gains if the meaning of quantum goes from small to big. But as we've already heard, language can be a powerful tool for the people who control it. Controlling words and their meanings is one of the most powerful tools of all. Inventing new ways of using words can be a creative process, but it can have a darker side. In the novel 1984, George Orwell introduced a language called Newspeak. It was an attempt to control thought through language. Today, author William Lutz talks about a language called Doublespeak, an effort to make meaningless words that once had meaning.
Really, the person who uses doublespeak wants to do any number of things, the worst of which, of course, is to evade the truth, to make something appear to be what it isn't, to avoid responsibility, generally to mislead, maybe even deceive, obfuscate, but certainly never to communicate.
Now, obviously, the best way to get an idea of this is for you to give us some examples. So,
okay, let me give you my recent example from the wonderful country of Canada. When some politicians some bureaucrats were caught spending an outrageous amount of money, $123 in Canadian money, for a waste paper basket, for one waste paper basket. Of course, they bought a lot of them. Did they say they bought a waste paper basket? You wouldn't spend $123 for a waste paper basket, but you might spend it for a user-friendly, space-effective, flexible desk-side sortation unit.
Get out. They didn't say that.
I never use anything that isn't documented.
Come on. Repeat that.
It's a user-friendly, space-effective, flexible, desk-side sortation unit.
So I'm getting the picture that the further you're squeezed into a corner, the more likely you are to come out with doublespeak to defend yourself.
The question always has to be, is this word necessary? And certainly, creating new words to meet new realities, new conditions, even new objects that are invented and come along, that's a normal part of language. But words like liaise, to face-to-face with someone, that kind of bureaucratic language moves into a subtle area of doublespeak that I call bureaucratese. That is, a language that is invented to make things sound impressive, to make people think that you must be really smart or your job must be really difficult because look at the language you have to use.
Have we reached the end of the line? Is a flexible desk-side sortation unit as low as we can go in the English language? Probably not, says science fiction writer Samuel Delaney. His explorations into the world of the future often have language as a major theme. He believes that the bureaucraties and computer mumbo-jumbo of today is just a taste of what we can come to expect in the English of the future.
I think you're going to have astonishing changes in the way language itself is used. Because we have this vast homogenized language, jargons become much more important. Idiosyncratic sub-languages. The great linguist Roman Jakobson made an extremely important point that may become even more and more important as we go on. He said that we all belong to many sub-language groups. We don't really speak the same language when we speak to our friends and family as we do when, indeed, we're sitting on a radio talk show, talking formally aware that an audience is listening, or when you're talking to a class. You talk to your boss with one language, you talk to your kids with another. These are all, there are slight differences. Well, these eventually become jargon differences in terms of particular professions that require language to do particular jobs, and in the same way doesn't require a great deal of other language because it only has certain jobs you have to do. Every particular jargon will have a context that will contour the kinds of things, the kinds of changes that are going to come into those languages. And so particular jobs are going to probably produce more and more mutually exclusive jargons, and those jargons are going to be controlled by the particular context that they're in. And that's probably going to be a very interesting area of language study.
There were some sophistos from the TV studios around the corner, laughing and greeting. The Devotchka was smacking away and not caring about the wicked world one bit.
It was a bleak picture of future language that Anthony Burgess painted in A Clockwork Orange, roving gangs of hooligans speaking their own chilling language. But it's not that different from the world of mutually unintelligible jargons that Samuel Delaney suggests might lie in our future, a world where the specialized languages of work attain their own linguistic status, each becoming a language of the street. It's not a surprising vision coming from a science fiction writer. What is surprising is that Delaney's idea of language fragmentation is supported by one of the world's foremost guardians of the English language. Dr. Robert Birchfield is currently writing a new version of the Grammarian's Bible, Fowler's Modern English Usage. He's also an editor of the Cambridge History of the English Language, but he thinks that history may be coming to an end.
I believe profoundly that each language has got within it some linguistic virus that causes it to change perpetually, and for adjacent or nearly adjacent forms of the parent language to change in different ways, to keep differentiating themselves from the language of the center. But my speculation leads me to believe that just as Latin broke up into Italian, Spanish, French, Portuguese, and so on, and the language called Germanic broke up into German, Swedish, Danish, Norwegian, English, Dutch, so will the English language itself break up into unintelligible forms in due course. British people will fight to the last ditch to retain standard English. I'm quite sure of that. But at the same time, its varieties will all be working on my thesis in their own way, constantly changing, spinning on their own axes, and becoming more and more different from standard English, a process of divergence, not of convergence.
Robert Birchfield thinks languages work in cycles of about 1,000 years. He figures English has been a dominant language for only about 200, so its disappearance is not imminent. In fact, there's a great deal of evidence that English is still in the ascendancy worldwide. It's the mother tongue of 500 million people, and the second language for an equal number. Two-thirds of all scientists write in English, and 80% of the information stored in computers around the world is in English. More important, English is the language of the United States, the world's largest economy and leading exporter of mass culture. And yet, as the importance of the language continues to grow, English itself is changing, breaking down, as Dr. Birchfield suggests, into smaller and smaller parts. Robert McCrum is co-author of the book The Story of English. He thinks this is a trend that's likely to continue.
And I think what you'll have is essentially two coexisting levels of language. At one level, you have what you might call some kind of international standard, which is loosely Americanized, American words, and may have a slight American accent, very slight, and that'll be used all over the place, internationally, both written and spoken. And then at another level, at a local level, whether it's city, town, village, whatever, there will be very distinct local varieties, which will be, to anybody who's got a sharp ear, quite different from even a few miles away.
There's just one thing I can't stand in my family. My baby, my stomach knows I can't ever get to sleep for a minute. He won't stop jumping or running the bathtub.
So English might survive, but in what form? Will the language of computers change the way we communicate with each other? The important thing is that language be rich enough to serve both the computer programmer and the poet. And that's why we may have reason to worry about the language of the future. Will the English of tomorrow offer us phrases like this from the 23rd Psalm? Yea, though I walk through the valley of the shadow of death, I will fear no evil. Science fiction writer Samuel Delaney says, don't count on it. Here's his idea of what the 23rd Psalm might sound like in the year 2093.
I have a supervisor. I need nothing more. My sleeping, my eating, my drinking is observed and controlled. My morality is controlled. Even if threatened by death, I need not fear. I need not think. Controls and aids are all around me. I am fed. My enemies starve while they watch me eat. My head is rubbed like a pet. My water dish is full to overflowing. My whole life I will frisk about the palace.
Samuel Delaney and his future version of the 23rd Psalm.
The revolution will be complete when the language is perfect.
The end of the revolution, the perfect language. Where might it come from? How about Hollywood? Those words were spoken by Klingons, the belligerent, samurai-like alien warriors with bony ridges on their foreheads from Star Trek. Those particular Klingons didn't say much. Their ships were vaporized shortly after that conversation. But Klingon the language lives on. Better than that, it's one of the fastest-growing languages on Earth. Klingon has been transformed from a few words in the first Star Trek movie to a linguistic industry. There's a Klingon Language Institute in Pennsylvania. They produce an academic journal in which linguists publish articles with titles like First Steps Towards a Phonological Theory of Klingon. There was even a Klingon language camp this summer in Minnesota. The man who started all this is Mark Okrand. He invented the Klingon language and wrote the Klingon Dictionary, 250,000 copies in print. Not the career you'd expect for a PhD linguist from University of California, Berkeley, who specialized in California native languages. But then, Mark Okrand is not your average linguist. If he were, he probably wouldn't have produced an audio tape called Conversational Klingon.
Here's another word with strong force. A Klingon might say it after receiving an unsettling communique. It's a lot stronger than the Terran, darn it. Hui-cha! The first sound of the word is r. It's the same as the last sound of torshach, but hum while you say it. Say it with me. R. I took the original dialogue from Star Trek The Motion Picture and wrote it down phonetically as best I could and said, okay, this is the start, and I kind of made a little chart of the sounds. Then I had to add sounds to it, and in adding the sounds, what I had in mind to do was making it guttural. Discordant guttural sounds, you know, portend evil of some sort. But also the particular choice of sounds I made were sounds that could be made by a human speaker because the language had to be spoken by human actors. But also the collection of sounds could not exist in a single human language. It's a little bit human because the Klingons are humanoid, as we like to say, but it breaks the rules of human languages at a number of points.
Do you understand the menu, Terran?
Hidrolev dayaj a trakan.
No. Help me.
Hobet hibok.
Do you trust me?
Trovok a.
Yes, I trust you.
Hija kavok.
I'll bring you dinner number 3.
Shochvad uk.
I was once at a convention. A linguistics convention in California about American Indian languages. It was a 3 or 4 day convention. And in the middle of it, a professor of linguistics at UCLA came up to me at a dinner. And she said, are you Mark Okrand? And I said, yes. She said, you wrote that Klingon dictionary, right? I said, yes. And I wasn't quite sure what was going to come next. She said, I want to tell you something. She said, I'm really serious, so don't laugh. I'm really pleased, she said, that there's now a genuine linguistics book that you could buy at an airport.
Will you drink, Terran?
Yes. What is there?
They serve black ale or Regulin blood wine.
It's impossible to predict the future of a language. There are just too many variables. Sounds change, new words enter, old words disappear. Social, political, and economic forces can turn language in completely unpredictable directions. And there are new forces, especially technological ones, whose role we are now only beginning to understand. As we heard today, not everyone is happy about what the future might hold for English, but at least it will survive, which is more than you can say for the vast majority of the world's 6,000 languages. As many as 95% of them might be doomed to extinction. That is what makes this era in the history of languages unique, and that's what makes it so important to appreciate the thousands of world languages for what they are. Ever-changing and powerful means of expressing what it is to be human. Talk,
The talk show, Talk of Tomorrow, was produced by Ira Basin for the Canadian Broadcasting Corporation. The reporter was Jay Ingram. The readings were from Laurie Stalbrand. Special thanks to Carolyn Lawrence. Now, here's our brain teaser for today. At the very beginning of our show today, maybe you recall, I tried talking backwards and I inserted the word frog every now and then. I was just trying to make up some kind of variation on standard English on the spur of the moment. You can do better. Write us a paragraph or so in the English of the future. Don't be arbitrary the way I was. Extrapolate from what you know, from what you hear going on around you. Don't use codes or ciphers, and if it's not obvious where your English comes from, add a couple of notes in today's English to explain it. Three winners, chosen for originality, creativity, and a drop of intelligibility, will receive a dazzling prize, provided you consider a T-shirt dazzling, and provided you do not work for National Public Radio or for Soundprint. Now,
Ik neop breksu sound zumbker sprinsky.
Write us at Brain Teaser, care of Soundprint.
If nerafnen, giblat killer the clock.
That's 2216 North Charles Street, Baltimore, Maryland, 21218.
Zu interneski punch a punch.
Or through internet.
Punch a muncha va va.
Where our address is Soundprint, SOUNDPRT.
Blab de blab de kabel de kuk.
At JHUVMS. That's JHUVMS. JHUVMS.HCF.JHU.EDU.
Bumpity, bumpity, bumpity.
Again, Soundprit, SOUNDPRT, at JHUVMS.HCF.JHU.EDU.
Wrangle, 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 wrangle.
Our executive producer is Moira Rankin. I'm Larry Massett.
Oreneski blathery rau rau de monnekrozom zidit.
You please shut up. Soundprint is produced at the Johns Hopkins University with support from the National Science Foundation and from radio stations KCRW-FM in Santa Monica, California, and WABE-FM in Atlanta, Georgia.
This program is provided by this and other National Public Radio member stations and the NPR Information Fund, whose contributors include the New Prospect Foundation, Orozaminano Biblop, Prison Rasam Nerske Bobo Karoyun Peter.
This is NPR, National Public Radio.